From Unconsciousness to Consciousness, Number 23. An Osho Talk, given spontaneously to an international audience in the USA. Have we failed you in any way that you have to start speaking again?
It is impossible to fail me. It is not in your hands. You can fail Moses if you don't follow his 10 commandments. I have not given you any commandments. You cannot go against me. You can fail Jesus very easily, because whatsoever he is telling you, teaching you, is against human nature. And you are human beings trying to be superhuman. You are bound to fail. I have not given you any superhuman ideas. I have never in any way persuaded you to go beyond your ordinariness. How can you fail me? Jesus says, love your enemy just the same as you love yourself. You may not be able to find the contradiction. First you accept somebody as your enemy. In that very acceptance you have hated him. And now Jesus is saying, love him. He is saying, love the person you hate. Translated directly, that's what his statement means. Love the person you hate. People have done it, but just the other way around. They have hated the persons they have loved. And the moment Jesus says, love the enemy, he is not aware of the fact that you cannot even love your friend without hating him. That hate and love are two sides of the same phenomenon. whomsoever you love, you hate too. Sometimes the hate comes up and love goes down, and sometimes the love comes up and the hate goes down, and in 24 hours you can watch the wheel of love and hate going up and down towards the same person. Jesus is talking about love but seems to know nothing about it. Because the first thing to know is that love and hate are not two things. You cannot separate them. If you want to love, you have to accept hate too. Yes, your love can be so understanding that it absorbs hate in itself, that you accept the hate as an essential part of it, that you don't hate hate. And you don't create a division in yourself. You cannot fail me for the simple reason because I have never expected anything from you. All these messiahs have been expecting things from you. You have to do this and you have not to do this. Once you go against their idea how you should be, you have failed, and you are going to fail them out of sheer necessity, because you cannot fulfill somebody else's idea. You have a being of your own which needs fulfillment. You have no responsibility towards me to fulfill my idea. My idea I have fulfilled. Now it is your idea, your being, your essence that has to be fulfilled. Nobody else can give you the discipline. But down the ages, people have ruled people in 1001 ways. They will rule over you through money. They will rule over you through power politics. They will rule over you through knowledgeability. They will rule over you by becoming a certain image that the society respects. For example, I would like to say something about Mahatma Gandhi. It was an everyday affair in his ashram that some disciple was failing him. Because what he was asking those poor people was so unnatural, so devoid of any reason and sense, that unless they were absolutely idiots, they were going to fail him. That was the only way to save themselves, otherwise they will be destroyed by him. In Mahatma Gandhi's ashram, you could not drink tea. That was enough to fail him. No, tea is such an innocent thing. Buddhist monks have used it for thousands of years as a help to meditation because it keeps you alert, awake. When you are feeling sleepy, just a cup of tea. And it brings you a little awareness. The story is that it was Bodhidharma who was determined to remain awake 24 hours. But body is body. The eyelids get tired. And when they get tired, the eyes close. He became so angry that he cut his eyelids and threw them in the grass. Now, eyes cannot be closed. It is a symbolic story. It has not happened, it cannot happen, because I know Bodhidharma perfectly well. He is the last person to do such a thing. But the story is significant, although it is just a story. Those eyelids grew into a plant that became the tea plant. And because those were eyelids of a man like Bodhidharma, the tea still carries the quality of awareness. That is the significance of the story. In every Buddhist monastery, the first thing is the tea. But in Gandhi's ashram, if somebody was caught drinking tea, it was a great sin. He has failed the master. And the master was a sadomasochist. All disciplinarians, whether they are Mahatmas, sages, rabbis, saints, principals, teachers, headmasters, all disciplinarians are deep down dictatorial. Discipline is a beautiful name for an ugly thing, dictatorship. But you cannot revolt against a disciplinarian. You can revolt against a dictator. You can revolt against Stalin. You can revolt against Mussolini. You cannot revolt against Mahatma Gandhi. And there is the danger. Why you cannot revolt against Mahatma Gandhi? Because before he disciplines you, he tortures himself. He is a sadomasochist. Before he tortures you, he tortures himself more than he is asking you. You cannot revolt. This man is not simply torturing you like Joseph Stalin. He has tortured himself. He has disciplined himself. Far deeper than he is asking you. How can you revolt against him? You cannot find any excuse. Gandhi had one ashram in South Africa in the beginning of his career of Mahatmahood. The ashram was called Phoenix Ashram. There he tortured his wife, his children, so immensely that I wonder nobody bothers and nobody thinks about it. And people like Lord Attenborough make films on Gandhi. And all that is essential, all that should be brought to the eyes of the people is completely left out. Perhaps these people like Attenborough are blind completely, blinded by his Mahatmahood. What he was doing to his wife, first she had to clean the toilet, and you don't know Indian toilet. Don't compare it with the Western toilet. The Western toilet can be clean, there is no problem. There is nothing to clean. It is already clean. But the Indian toilet is really dirty. And Kasturba Gandhi's wife could not say no either, because Gandhi himself was cleaning. When the husband is cleaning, she knew that he is a Mahatma. She knew that it is a dirty job and she does not feel like cleaning other people's dirt and carry it out from the outhouse way back and throw the all shit into a ditch, because Gandhi has this idea that the shit should not be misused. Everything has to be used. He was really a miser. There is no question why he suffered from constipation his whole life. He was carrying the enema with himself everywhere. It is his psychology. The shit has to be collected and thrown into a ditch behind the house, and then over it mud has to be thrown, so it becomes manure for the next year's crops. Now for Kasturba it was so difficult. And the way in India it is to be carried, you cannot believe. But in India they have reduced 1/4 of the country into such a state that they are not allowed to do any other work. So only these works are available. They have to do it. They are born to do it, that is their destiny. So they collect the shit in buckets and carry over their heads. Miles. In India, Kasturba has never thought that she will have to do this because she belonged to a higher caste. She was not a Sudra, an untouchable. But Gandhi was carrying himself, so he was the Mahatma. And when he carries, then he gets a subtle right over you. You have to understand the subtle power politics in such a small things. Because he gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning, everybody has to get up 3 o'clock in the morning. And when the old man is getting at 3 o'clock, you are young, you will feel guilty if you don't get up. And if you are caught, then you have failed the master. And what the master is going to do, he will not punish you, he will punish himself. Because he had this egoistic idea that if he is truly pure, then nothing can go wrong around him. Then everything is going to be right. If anything goes wrong, that simply means something is impure in him. So he has to purify himself by fasting. So if you fail him, he will torture himself. That will create even more burden on you. First, guilt that you failed him. Second, guilt that now he is suffering because of your stupidity. You could have awakened at 3 o'clock. It was not such a big deal. And now for a few days, nobody knows, because he will always start fast unto death. Although he never fasted unto death, but he will start always fast unto death. Then he has to be persuaded. Then all the leaders of the country have to run to his ashram and ask him that just for one man's failure, you cannot punish the whole country. Then after 2-3 days, he will be ready to take. And that man is condemned by the whole country. He has been punished more than you could have imagined. Wherever he goes, people talk about him. This is the man for whom Gandhi is fasting unto death. And if he dies, they will kill this man. They will not leave this man alive. Gandhi, one night, threw Kasturba, who was pregnant, out of the house because she was reluctant to clean the latrine. A pregnant woman, a woman who does not know any other language in a foreign country, absolutely dependent on him, and he closed the door, threw her out and said, if you don't clean the latrine, then this is not your house, then you don't belong to me. If you cannot follow my discipline, then who else is going to listen to me? If my own wife fails me, in the cold winter, Kasturba wept outside and finally decided that she should agree to clean the latrine. Only when she accepted to clean the latrine, she was allowed in. Now, you can fail such a man very easily by anything, just by smoking a cigarette, drinking a cup of tea, anything. He did not allow his children to be educated. He didn't send them to schools. They wanted. The mother wanted. Naturally, she wanted that they should be educated, otherwise who is going to feed them and their whole life is ahead of them? You are educated, you are a barrister, you earn, and you are a Mahatma. Even if you don't earn, you have thousands of worshippers, but your children? And you don't send them even to the primary school? And he was against the education that is available in the schools, colleges and universities. Why? Because it creates doubt. It destroys people's faith. Because it teaches people science and technology, of which he was against. Against things so simple and so essential that you will not be able to believe that in 20th century a man can be against telephone. Now, telephone does not do any harm to anybody. One can be against nuclear weapons, I can understand. But telephone? Railway lines? Trains? Aeroplanes, he was against anything except the spinning wheel. That was the only technology that he accepted. Beyond that, all technology was evil. All science was evil. So why send your children to learn devilish ways of science, technology, logic, philosophy, and destroy their faith, their belief in God? No, he will not send them. His eldest son Haridas escaped, seeing the situation that this man is going to destroy our lives completely. He escaped, reached to a relative's family and told the whole story that what is happening. I want to go to a school. Just see this situation. The boy has to escape from the home to get into a school. Boy escape from a school not to go there. And Haridas had to go from his home and ask some uncle, a far relative, far away relative, that please help me, at least I would like to be a matriculate, then I will see later on, but up to matriculate, that much education is absolutely necessary. Gandhi was very angry. The prophet of non-violence was angry, violently angry. What he said that now this home is closed for Haridas. He should not be allowed in, and nobody from my family should meet with him. Even the mother, the brothers, the sisters, nobody should see him and meet him. If anybody meets with him, he also goes with him. He has failed me. You impose such stupid ideas. Now what Haridas was doing was perfectly right. This man had to be disobeyed. The other children did not escape. They were weaklings. Haridas has some guts. And he showed later on that he had some guts. Gandhi used to say that all religions are one. That was also a political gimmick. That all religions are one. Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian, Jaina, Buddhist, Sikh, all religions are one. But the basic politics was to capture all these people and their votes. And to keep the whole India undivided so that Gandhi's party rules over the whole of India, not only a part of India. In his prayer meetings every morning, Quran was recited, Bible was read, and other holy books also were included. Just few pieces read from Bible, few pieces read from Torah, few pieces read from Quran. And there was too great cunningness. Because I have looked into those pieces that were read, they were the pieces which were synonymous with Gita. Only those pieces were chosen from the Bible that were synonymous with Krishna. Because Gandhi used to call Gita his mother. He never called Quran my father or Bible my uncle, at least. Only Gita his mother. And all these fragments that he has chosen were deceptive. They were simply translations as if of the same message. So there was no problem. All that was against Gita or different from Gita, not even against, was not chosen. So he was deceiving Mohammedans, he was deceiving Christians, he was deceiving Jainas, he was deceiving Buddhists, he was deceiving Sikhs, everybody. And they all thought that this man is a super sage. That is the meaning of Mahatma, the great soul. As if souls are also small and great. Souls are simply souls, neither small nor great. But the great soul, Mahatma, because he is so liberal, unprejudiced, and he was full of prejudice. Haridas knew it. So what he did, he converted himself into a Mohammedan. He did well. I appreciate him. The doors of the home were closed. Gandhi has abandoned him, declared that he is no more my son, I am no more his father. He has utterly failed me. If he had died, it would have been better. And what sin he had committed? He had gone to school. But he was really an intelligent boy. As he left the school, he turned himself into a Mohammedan. And Mohammedans rejoiced. They enjoyed the idea that Gandhi's eldest son finds shelter into Mohammedanism. They started calling him Mahatma Abdullah Gandhi. They kept Mahatma and Gandhi, so people remember who he is, and changed Haridas into Abdullah, which means exactly Haridas. Abd Allah, servant of God. And that is the meaning of Haridas, servant of God. It is Arabic translation of Haridas. So it was exactly the same. But Gandhi was so shocked. You can imagine if just going to his school was enough to abandon him as a son. Now he has become a Mohammedan. Gandhi wept. Now this is the man who says all the religions are same. So what is the difference? Whether he is Hindu or Mohammedan, what difference does it make? And even his name is nothing but an Arabic translation of the Sanskrit name. Exact translation. Just by coincidence, there was a meeting in Bombay. Just by coincidence, Gandhi was going in the same train from which Haridas was getting out. Kasturba, after all, was a mother. She wanted at least to have a look at the son. She knew that her husband won't allow to talk. But Gandhi did not allow even to see. He said, remember, don't look at him. He is dead for us. He has slapped me on my face by becoming a Mohammedan. He forgot all that synthesis of all religions And still the prayer continues the same way every day. You can fail this type of people very easily. You cannot fail me. It is impossible. There is no way to fail me. Because I don't impose any discipline on you, how can you fail me? I don't give you any doctrine. Against which you can go, how can you go against me? All that I go on telling to you is be authentically yourself. Now the only way to fail me is not to be yourself. How can you do it? And it is good that you cannot do it. It is not your failing me that I have started speaking. It has nothing to do with you. I am just a man who lives moment to moment. One day I felt like going into silence. I went into silence. Anybody in my place would not have gone into silence that way. Because so much was incomplete, so many things have to be done. But I can't care less. Because one day I will die and things will be incomplete. Have I to postpone my death too? I live life as I will live death, moment to moment. If things are incomplete, let them be incomplete. Perhaps that is their destiny. Perhaps somebody else will complete them. Who am I to be bothered? So one day I stopped because I felt like, and one day I started speaking. Just I told Sila, that time also, it was poor Sila, I told her, I'm going to stop speaking. She was shocked. What will happen to the whole movement? How the sannyasins will survive? They have become so accustomed of hearing me every day. It has become their nourishment, daily nourishment. But I never consider anything. I am very inconsiderate. Whatsoever I feel, I do. Without thinking at all about the consequences. I am ready to accept any consequence happily. Again, it was poor Sila. I told her, I'm going to speak today. She asked me, But arrangements have to be made and this and that. Cannot be tomorrow, I said, no. That is your business, arrangements and other things. I am going to speak today. It has nothing to do with you. It is just my way of life, moment to moment, remaining spontaneous, remaining unpredictable, not only to you or to the world at large, to myself I am unpredictable. I don't know tomorrow. I may not speak, I may stop again. I cannot guarantee about tomorrow because tomorrow is not in my hands. It is open, undecided. We will see when it comes. We will see what it brings. And I have lived this way my whole life. One day I left my family. They were all worried about me. They wanted me to go to a science college. And I simply refused. I said, that is not my interest. I am going to study philosophy, religion, psychology. That is my interest. Because against philosophers, theologians, priests, psychologists, I am going to fight my whole life. This is, my father said, a strange interest. You are going to fight against these people? I said, yes, that's why I have to study them as deeply as possible. With science, I have no conflict. Science I am going to use. But the religions, the philosophers, these people I am going to fight. My father said, will you ever come to your senses or not? I am not going to give you a single pie to study in any arts college. I said, I have not asked for a single pie. Even if you give me, I will not accept. And he was not thinking that I was serious. He loved me so much. I left home without taking a single pie from my parents. I traveled without ticket 80 miles away to the nearest university. When my father saw that I had really gone, he rushed towards the station. By the time he reached, the train has left. He inquired, people said that yes, we have seen him. He has gone. He followed me by the next train, got hold of me, said that don't take my word seriously. I was just trying to persuade you some way that you go to a science college, become a doctor, become a engineer. What you are going to gain out of art, as that is not the point at all. I am not after gain. And I cannot conceive myself being a doctor. I would rather commit suicide. Constructing bridges and houses, I cannot think of myself as an engineer. That is not anywhere in my being. I don't feel any synchronicity. No bell rings in me. Seeing a doctor, I say, poor fellow. The whole life he will be just bothering about diseases, sicknesses, sick people. And will completely forget that his own whole life, his own life, is going down the drain every moment. And he is thinking about other people's life and how to save them. And he has forgotten completely that he is not saved yet. He said, "You forgive me. You go to the arts college. I will be sending you money." I said, "I cannot accept. You know me. You told me you will not give." I said, "Even if you give, I will not accept. Now you are giving. I am not accepting." And I did not accept money from him. In the night I worked as a journalist in a daily newspaper as an editor, and in the day I was going to the university, and he was really very much troubled. Every month he will be coming again and again. It took 2 years for him. Then one day when he came, I said, "Okay, I accept." He had not said a single word. I said, "You don't say a single word. If you say a single word, then I have told you that if you give me, I will reject. So you don't give me, and I will not reject. You simply go on keeping the money here on my table whenever you feel I will need. Neither you give nor I accept." And that's how it continued for 6 years. He will put the money. He will not say to me that this is for you, because if he said that, that will trouble. Now I will talk about the money. Money was not a thing to be discussed, because we had settled long before about it. Of course, I had not said that if I find money on my table, I will not take it. I have lived without thinking of the past, without thinking of the future. And I have found that that is the only way to live. otherwise. You only pretend to live. You don't live. You hope to live, but you don't live. You remember that you had lived, but you have not lived. Either it is memory or it is imagination, but it is never reality. And I don't make anybody responsible towards me. Try to understand my basic approach. All the religions have said that you are responsible towards God, towards Jesus, towards Buddha, towards your parents, towards your teachers, towards this, towards that. None of them has said that you are responsible only towards yourself. And I say to you that you are not responsible towards God, because God exists nowhere. You are not responsible towards Jesus, because Jesus was not responsible to you. So what business you have to be responsible towards Jesus? You are not responsible to your parents. Because they had not asked you that we are going to give birth to you, are you ready to come into the world or not? You came to them just accidentally. I say to you, you are responsible only to yourself. And the miracle of this statement is that if you are responsible towards your own being, you will find many responsibilities are being fulfilled without being considered at all. I was never responsible to my parents, but I don't think anybody else could have fulfilled his responsibility towards his parents better than I have done it. But I have not done it. It is just a byproduct of my responsibility towards myself. The moment I was fulfilled, the moment I was blessed by truth, of course I wanted it to be shared. And it was natural that I would share it with my father, with my mother, with my brothers, with my sisters, whom I had known longer than anybody else. And I shared it. I never asked them to become sannyasins. Never. It was their decision to become sannyasins. If they wanted to become sannyasins, it was their decision. If you have become sannyasins, it is your decision. I do not convert people. I think of conversion as one of the dirtiest things one can do to you. Christian missionaries go on doing it to people, converting. Who are you to convert anybody? You can open your heart. If you have some light there, you can share it with others. If they feel it, they will start searching within themselves. It will not be a conversion, it will be an inversion. If you know me well, you will try to know yourself well. That's the only way. Knowing me well, you cannot feel responsible towards me. You will feel responsible, utterly responsible towards yourself. So much life you have wasted, and who knows how little is left. So each moment has to be lived intensely, totally, fully. You can fail yourself. You cannot fail me. The person who could fail me is dead. It was I myself before I knew. That was the person who could have failed me. But instead of failing me, he died. Because only in his death was my life. Only by dying, it created the space for my life to grow. So I am thankful to the dead person that once I was, and I will remain thankful for eternity. You cannot fail me because you are not responsible towards me. You can either be fulfilled, then you will be grateful, thankful, or you can remain unfulfilled, then you will be angry with me. As if I have prevented your growth. Neither I can help your growth, nor I can prevent your growth. I can only share my growth, expose myself in utter nudity to you, so that you can see what happens when one comes home, when one arrives. And that glimpse may trigger the process of transformation, not of conversion, but of transformation.
What is the difference between the Christian way of being selfless, modest, and humble, and your way of being egoless and ordinary?
The Christian way of being humble, modest, selfless is basically wrong. Because the words they are using may sound to be exactly the same that I use, but they don't mean the same. When Jesus says, be humble, what he means? He means just the opposite of the ego. The ego is standing on its head, but the ego is there, upside down. When I say be ordinary, the ordinary is not against the ego. The ordinary man is not humble. I am not a humble man. I am not an egoist. I am just exactly in the middle. The humble man is exactly opposite the egoist. I am reminded of a small story. There were three Christian monasteries very close to each other, belonging to three different denominations. One day, just by chance, the chiefs of all the three monasteries met on a morning walk. They sat under a tree to rest for a while. One of them said, your monasteries are also doing our Lord's work. Carefully take note what he is saying. Your monasteries are also doing our Lord's work, but as far as scholarship is concerned, you cannot beat our monastery. The second chief said, I agree perfectly. Your monasteries are also doing our Lord's work, but as far as service to the poor, to the sick, to the old, to the orphans is concerned, you cannot come even closer to us. You are far back. The third monk said, you both are right. Your monasteries are doing our Lord's work. And this is true. The first monastery has great scholars in it. The second monastery has great servants of the people, of the poor, of the sick. But as far as humbleness is concerned, we are the tops. Humbleness is nothing but ego is standing upside down. A humble person is not egoless. He has repressed his ego, forced his ego to stand on its head. He is trying to be the humblest man in the whole world. But what is ego? Somebody is trying to be the richest man in the world, then it is ego. And somebody is trying to be the humblest man in the world, then it is not ego. If the president thinks he is at the tops, then it is ego. And when the saint starts talking that he is at the tops, as far as humbleness is concerned, everybody is below him, then it is not ego. Jesus has to be analyzed very carefully. He says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the kingdom of God. To be meek on one hand. But why to be meek? The motive is given in the other part of the sentence, to inherit the kingdom of God. Great meekness. Jesus says, if somebody hits you on one cheek, give him the other too. And these statements look so beautiful because you have been conditioned to hear them again and again. And you have completely forgotten that they have to be analyzed, psychologically understood. A great research is needed, in-depth research is needed in a statement like this. When somebody hits you on one cheek, Jesus says, give him the other too. Looks that he is teaching non-violence, he is teaching love, compassion. But what he is teaching is, he is teaching you to behave like a superman and reduce the other man into subhumanity. Have you ever thought that if somebody hits you and you give him the other cheek, what you are doing to him? Are you not saying to him, look, I am a saint? Yes, you are not saying it, but it is all over the place. It is quite loud, you are not saying it. That look at my saintlihood, my humbleness, my meekness, that you hit me on one cheek, I give you the other. When Jesus was teaching this message to his disciples, one of them had asked him, "And if he hits on the other too?" Jesus may not have thought of the possibility of such a question. Yes, that is possible, because if you yourself are offering another cheek, it will be just ungrateful not to accept the offer. And if you enjoyed the first so much that you are welcoming the other, he may give even a stronger hit. So the man asks, then what we have to do? Jesus said, you have to forgive 7 times. He said, okay. The way he said, okay. It was clear that he knows that 7 times. He can tolerate. But let the 8th come. And just in one single hit, I will show him that what he has not been able to do in 7, I can do in a single 1. Looking at the man the way he said, okay. Jesus said, no, 77 times. But even 77 times will be finished. Jesus is not trying to solve the problem simply postponing it. First he postponed for 2x, then 7 times. Now seeing the person that it makes no difference. After 7 times he will do exactly the same that he would have done in the 2nd time, in the 1st time, in the 1st place. But he is again postponing it, making it longer. 77 times. But I say even 77 times will be finished. Then your humbleness will be finished too. And then what you are going to do? No, this is not the right way. You are not being humble. On the contrary, you are humiliating the other person. Jesus has told to give him the other cheek. Deep down, he is saying, humiliate him. He may not be conscious himself of what he is saying. He may be thinking that he is giving you a great teaching. I do not doubt his intention. But his intention is not in question at all. What is in question is the statement, the principle. What is the basic psychology in it? Somebody hits you and you give him your other cheek. You reduce him into a subhuman being. And deep down your ego is fulfilled, so pious. But the ego feeling pious is far more dangerous than the ego feeling wrong, ugly. Because you can get rid of the ugly ego, you cannot get rid of the pious ego. The pious ego is a treasure to be saved, to be protected. That man has made you a saint. That's what Jesus did himself on the cross. Even on the cross, he is humiliating the people. He is asking God, forgive these people because they know not what they are doing. As if he knows. In fact, those people perfectly know what they are doing. They know that they are crucifying you because of your claim that you are the Messiah. And the scriptures say that the Messiah will be crucified and the miracle will happen. He will be resurrected by God. And that will be the only proof of his being the true Messiah, otherwise he is a false one. They knew perfectly well what they are doing. But even hanging on the cross, the pious ego still has the last word. God, Father, forgive these poor people. They don't know what they are doing. Only he knows and nobody else knows there. And what does he know? Just few moments before he was asking God himself, that have you forsaken me? There was doubt. He was shocked that the miracle is not happening. That nothing is happening, that the sky is absolutely silent. No response. All kinds of doubts must have arisen in his mind. You can think yourself on the cross. And you have been declaring, and he believed it. I never doubt his intention. It was not that he was befooling or cheating. He was not a fraud. He was sincerely insane. He believed he is the Messiah who has come to redeem the whole humanity. And he went to crucifixion himself. There is every possibility of a strange conspiracy. Only Gurdjieff used to talk about it. He was the first man to talk about it. Christians, of course, cannot talk about it. And Jews have never bothered after the crucifixion. They have not even mentioned anywhere that this carpenter's son is crucified. They simply ignored, just a mad guy. Their history books, their religious books, nowhere the crucifixion is mentioned. Other than Christian books, that is the New Testament, which was written 300 years after Jesus' crucifixion, so-called crucifixion, Gurdjieff has few very significant ideas. I can only call them ideas because they cannot be authenticated by any other source. But Gurdjieff is a man of penetrating mind. One idea was that the story of Jesus is not historical. It was a drama that was played year after year in olden times. Just as Rama's story in India is played year after year for 5,000 years, even today, every year in every village, every town, every city, even the smallest village has its own group of actors playing the story of Rama, Ram Leela. The same time of the year the story is played. There is a possibility that there has never been such a man as Rama. It has been only a story, but it has been played for 5,000 years continuously, that it has taken a historicalness about itself. Gurdjieff said Jesus' crucifixion and the whole story of Jesus was a drama played every year. So there was no historical thing happening. I don't agree with this, because if it was so, the Jews would have continued to play their story just as Hindus have continued to play their story. Why they stopped? What happened? The story is beautiful. Why Jews simply stopped it? And no Jewish source mentions it even as a story. And if it was being played for thousands of years, it is impossible there was no other source where it was related. And then why suddenly it stopped 2,000 years before? No. It cannot be just a drama. And a drama cannot create so much trouble in the world. A drama cannot create Christianity. A drama cannot create all that the Christians have done to humanity. No, no drama is so powerful. His second idea is also very significant, and there are moments when I think perhaps he is right about the second idea. With the first idea, I simply disagree with him. But the second idea is that Judas has not betrayed Jesus. He is Jesus' closest disciple. It is Jesus who persuades Judas to deliver him to the enemies. That too has no source anywhere. Gurdjieff was a strange man. But once in a while he used to stumble upon certain fragments of truth, certain aspects. I can see some possibility of truth in this. Because there was no need for Judas to betray. They have been never in fight. There was no question about his being the successor. Because he was the most literate, most cultured, most educated person amongst his apostles. All were just very ordinary people from the masses. He was the only one. He was far better educated, far better cultured than Jesus himself. It was absolutely certain that he is going to take over. Once Jesus is gone, there was nobody to compete with him. There was no conflict. There has been no fight. And it is not possible that he will sell his master for 30 silver pieces. And if he was really so much against Jesus, then why he committed suicide after Jesus' crucifixion? Christians don't talk about Judas' suicide, which is very significant. Perhaps Gurdjieff is right. Perhaps Jesus persuaded Judas, ordered Judas that you go and deliver me to them. And deliver in such a way that they don't suspect that you are being sent by me. So if they offer some bribe, you accept. They offered 30 silver pieces. He accepted gratefully. And he brought them to the place where Jesus was staying. And Jesus was caught. And the next day he was crucified. It seems Gurdjieff has a point there. Because Jesus knows beforehand that he is going to be crucified tomorrow. How he knows it? He knows that Judas is going to deliver him to the enemies. How he knows it? Christians will say he is all-knowing. He is omniscient. He is Son of God. But what happens to the Son of God on the cross? Suddenly God abandons the Son, forgets about him, does not listen to his prayer? No, the possibility is he knows, because it is his own plan that he should be delivered to the high priest, and only Judas could do it because he was so obedient. And he could be relied upon. The others were emotionally attached to Jesus. Only Judas was intellectually attached to Jesus. The others were not reliable. They may say, no, we cannot do this. How can we do this to you? What are you talking about? And even if they were sent, they would have come back without telling anybody about Jesus. They were simple folk. Only Judas was capable of some integrity. And if Jesus says that this is the way, how we have to function? You deliver me to the high priest and let them crucify me, and let God show the miracle of resurrection. So immediately we become recognized. And we can transform the whole world and redeem everybody from suffering. And Judas believed it. He is not against Jesus, and he is not betraying Jesus. He is really obeying him, obeying to the very extreme. Only a very obedient disciple can do that. But he also believed that there is no problem in crucifixion. Crucifixion is just a game. He is the Son of God. You should put yourself in Judas' position. Then you can understand that he was not betraying. He never thought for a single moment that this is a betrayal. He is simply fulfilling the plan. And the Master is giving him the order. And it is written in the scriptures that the Messiah will be betrayed by his own disciple. So everything is written in the scriptures. He knows the scriptures. He is the only person who can read. So a disciple has to play the role. It is just a role. Because he believed totally. After resurrection, the world will be redeemed. And he is doing a great service to humanity. He is not betraying Jesus. He is fulfilling his mission on the earth. Gurdjieff's idea is a little outlandish. But worth consideration. Anyway, whether it is right or wrong, one thing is certain, that Jesus was very keen to be crucified. More keen than the chief priest of the great temple of the Jews. He rushes fast towards Jerusalem for the annual festival. Because it is known all over the country that this time if Jesus comes to the temple, last year he had created chaos in the temple. He has upturned the tables of the money changers, thrown them out, had beaten them, and declared that this business cannot continue in my father's house. The temple is my father's house. So it was for 1 year continuously a rumor around that next time if he comes, the priests are ready. Last year they were not ready. It happened suddenly. They could not do anything. But this time they are getting ready and they have persuaded the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, that this man is dangerous religiously to us and politically to you. Jesus knew all these rumors were reaching to him through his disciples and people and travelers, but he was still rushing towards the festival. For what? Has a tendency for being a martyr. That is another name for the suicidal instinct, a good name. But believed, madly believed that nobody can harm him when God is the Savior. Who can harm him? But on the cross, his hopes disappeared, but still the ego, the arrogance of the humble man who always forgives even if you crucify him is there. These poor people should be forgiven. And who were these poor people? Rabbis, learned. Their whole life they have wasted in learning the Torah, the high priest, and hundreds other rabbis, because the temple of the Jews was one of the biggest temple in the world. Hundreds of priests were functioning there, working there. And the chief priest, the high priest, was in an egoistic conflict with Jesus. Unless Jesus had that ego there, the conflict would not have arisen. It was the rule that every year the centralmost shrine of the temple was opened, and the only man who entered there was the high priest, and the door was closed. Only he was allowed to utter the name of God. That's why you will be surprised in Jewish books written in English. They don't write G-O-D, God, because that will be pronouncing the full name. the O is dropped. Empty space in place of O. G, empty space for O, and D. You should not pronounce, because unless you are pure enough, you should not pronounce the name of God. Only the high priest was entitled to pronounce the name of God. Others were not entitled even to hear it. So the door was closed in the innermost shrine, completely closed, one door only. Then he will call God and pray and ask for the redemption of the Jews, send the Messiah. And this man, Jesus, last year entered into the temple, disturbed the whole structure of the temple, the system of the temple, and declared himself the Messiah. Not only that, he declared, I am the only begotten Son of God, and this is my Father's house. And what business it is that you are doing? I will not allow this kind of business here. Get out of the temple. Now, this was a sure challenge for the high priest, that even a higher priest has arrived, the Messiah has arrived, the prayer has been heard. Not only the Messiah, he has sent his own son. Now this son has to be somehow finished. Otherwise, the purpose, the function of the high priest and the 1,000 priests and the whole temple is lost. He rushed, got caught, was crucified. But even in crucifixion, his arrogance is the same. He asks these people should be forgiven because they know not what they are doing. If you enter into deeper in such statements, you will be surprised that what appears on the surface is not the whole reality. So when the Christians say humble, they mean the ego has been repressed. But it has come from the back door, claiming that I am the most humble person. When they say selfless, they tell you to practice selflessness. Be humble. Once a Christian monk came to see me. He was traveling all over India. And one of my Christian friends has given him a letter that if he passes through my city, he must see me. And he has written a letter to me that brother so-and-so is coming in these dates, and he is the humblest person you will ever come across. Absolutely selfless. He is exactly what you teach. So I am telling him to meet you. And I implore you also to meet with him. He is a man worth meeting. And brother so-and-so appeared one day morning. He was carrying a Bible and was living just like a Hindu monk. Looked very simple, gentlemanly. But I didn't say to him to sit down. He said, "Your friend has sent me." I said, "I have received the letter." "But why are you carrying that rubbish with you?" He said, "Rubbish? This is Holy Bible." I said, "This is holy nonsense." And his eyes became fire. And he said, "What kind of man you are?" And my friend was saying that I will be welcomed and received, and you have not even told to sit in. You have not told, even asked me to sit down. And you called my Holy Bible holy nonsense, rubbish. I cannot stay here anymore. I said, "I don't want you to stay here anymore, because you are not the person whom he describes in this letter, that brother so-and-so is very humble. The humblest person you will ever come across. You are not a humble person. If you were, what is wrong in calling your Bible rubbish? You should have laughed. You should have said, 'Okay, that is your opinion.' And if I have not asked you to sit down, I had not prevented you to, the chair was there. Why you were waiting for me to tell you to sit down? A humble person. You could have sit down. I have not prevented you. And just think of your anger. You are enraged." I said, "Now I say, please sit down. Put your Holy Bible here on the table." He said, "No. I cannot stay here a single moment more. You are a dangerous man. You disturbed my 20 years humbleness." I said, "A humbleness which has been practiced for 20 years is disturbed within 20 seconds is not much worth. You can repress the self, you can repress the ego, you can behave the way a humble man behaves. You can discipline yourself in any way. But it is all circus, disciplining. Deep down you will remain the same. Anybody who knows how to scratch your thin layer of discipline can bring your reality out within seconds. When I say be without the ego, I am not saying repress the ego. I am saying try to understand the ego. I am not saying fight with it. I am saying become aware of it. And the more you become aware of the ego, the less it is. The day you are fully aware of the ego, it is not found. When the ego is not found, then a quality like fragrance arises in you, which is humbleness, which I call ordinariness, just to make the difference from the humbleness, because that humble word has been so much misused by religious people that I have to use the word ordinariness, because no religion have used that word. So I don't want to use the word humble, selfless. I would like that you simply understand that I'm just ordinary as everybody else is ordinary. And this understanding comes by becoming aware of the ego, not by repressing it. One woman has written a letter in which she says that you are not a gentleman. Not only that, you are not even a Christian. I started to think that is to be a Christian a necessary condition for being a gentleman? Then the whole world who is not Christian is not gentlemanly. Only Christians are gentlemen. And my experience shows, and your experience shows, this is not the case. Christians, because of Jesus' egoistic claims, continue in the same egoistic stream. Their Pope is infallible. I used to think that I have come to know all kinds of idiots. But coming here in Oregon, I came to know that that was not right. The Oregonian idiot is a special category in itself.